Welcome back, everybody. Give him a warm welcome. Bart De Smet.
Okay, a very good morning, everyone. Welcome to this talk about .NET 4.0 CLR. My name is, you know, as you heard, Bart De Smet. I'm working in the Cloud Programmability team at Microsoft Corporation in Redmond. Before that, I was actually working in the developer division, where I was responsible for parts of WPF. And so, you know, as we built on top of the CLR, and I'm a language geek and a runtime geek, spent quite some time figuring out what's new in .NET 4 CLR and sort of followed the evolution quite closely. So that's what I'm going to talk about today. Now, I also do have, of course, an email address in those days. So if you have any question, you know, any technical question on the subject, please send me an email. If I don't know the answer, I'll be honest and just forward it to, you know, the responsible people. I also have a blog on which I mainly talk about language topics, about runtime topics, so you will find some background information over there as well. So let's get started immediately. And I wanted to have a subtitle for this session. When I thought about it, like what's new in the CLR, I sort of wanted to have a big theme that I could sort of hang all my topics onto. And I came to the conclusion that it's all about the C and common language runtime, meaning that we make that C for common even bigger. Like today, we have functional languages, we have dynamic languages, we have all of that stuff. And of course, if you want to do a common language runtime, it's better that you can accommodate for all of those. So there are quite some features in the CLR that accommodate for those kind of principles and those kind of new languages. So it's sort of, you know, improving on the existing foundation that we have, reaching out, you know, to more technologies. So that's a key theme throughout my presentation. Near the end, I will also have some BCL coverage, which, you know, sort of also fits in the bucket of common language runtime because it's stuff that people use all over the place. So first of all, let's actually take a look at the history, because there are some very interesting trends that we sort of see in the history of the CLR. So first of all, we sort of worked on the CLR for quite a while. In the late 90s, actually, the project was started as Codename Lightning at that point. And so when .NET 1.0 was actually released in 2002, you know, big news, of course. And 1 year later, we have .NET 1.1. And one of the important things there is that we had an update to the CLR at that point in time as well. So in 2002, we had a CLR. In 2003, we had some updates to the thing, and so forth. And actually, in 2005, again, we had an update to the CLR in .NET 2.0, introducing things like generics, nullable types, which actually requires changes to the underlying foundation. But then something changed, because .NET 3.0 and .NET 3.5 didn't ship with a new CLR. They shipped with an update for the CLR, a service spec release. Like .NET 2.0 CLR is now at service spec 2 level, which ships with .NET 3.5 SP1. I have that whole matrix in my head, and I really need to see, you know, a psychiatrist about that, because it's just, you know, too confusing. But 3.0 and 3.5 are just, you know, additional incremental releases, adding more stuff to the framework and not really changing the underlying fundamentals of the CLR. So that's an important change that you see there, meaning that the velocity of the CLR evolution is sort of decoupled from the framework evolution. Now in 4.0, where we are today, we actually have updated both. We have new libraries, of course, but we also have updated the CLR with additional functionality. So that's what we're going to talk about today. Now, beyond, most likely you will see something like .NET 4.1 or 4.5 or 5.0, I don't know what it will be called, being based on CLR 4.0. So it's sort of natural that the CLR evolves at a slower pace than the stuff on top of it, because it's sort of maturing as the underlying foundation. So here's actually the overview slide. We'll be talking about quite a few of those things inside the big box. But what I want to emphasize in this slide is that the common language runtime is not the only language runtime anymore in .NET 4.0. And I sort of see the dynamic language runtime, which I will also touch upon briefly, as sort of an extension to the CLR. It's also about, you know, common language support, in this particular case for dynamic languages. So you sort of see that the CLR is sort of growing, but at the same time we do that by introducing new libraries as opposed to changing the underlying infrastructure all over the place. came to the conclusion that to support dynamic languages, we don't need to change the IL instruction set. We don't need to change, you know, the JIT compiler that much. We've done some stuff in the garbage collector that we can collect existing code that lives in some app domain. So we have some changes there. So let's continue and actually look at the first big theme, which we've always had in the past as well, which is called runtime side-by-side. So runtime side-by-side means that the .NET versions can sit alongside each other, meaning that if your application is compiled for 2.0 and you have 2.0 and 4.0 on the machine, it will run against the 2.0 CLR. Now, in the past, we actually had something like between .NET 1.1 and 2.0, people were sort of, you know, taking their existing code and running it on 2.0 and came to the conclusion that certain things broke. And the reason was, well, it's a sample inside Microsoft that I'm using here. We had some add-in to Outlook, and they were relying on some timing, some subtle timing between thread start and actually the time the delegate that you pass to a thread starts executing. They were relying on some subtle, you know, race condition there. And what actually happened was that their code basically didn't work anymore on 2.0 because the timing subtly was actually changing. So one thing we don't want to do is automatically roll forward your application from, say, 2.0 CLR to run automatically on 4.0. So we can actually have .NET 4.0 sitting just next to .NET 2.0, and your application takes affinity to the CLR it was built for. Now, what we've actually done in addition to that in .NET 4.0 is give you the ability to, without recompiling your code, roll forward your application to .NET 4.0 if you've just checked that actually the application behaves well. The libraries are backwards compatible. We have, you know, done great investments in making sure that the runtime is also compatible. But, you know, there might always be those little side effects that you rely on, maybe without even knowing that that's the case, because your code always worked and you're relying on some subtle thing like timing. So in order to roll forward an existing application to .NET 4.0, you can basically do this particular configuration trick. That means that if you land on a machine that runs only .NET 4.0, which is backwards compatible with 2.0, 3.0, 3.5, and all of that stuff, the application won't require CLR 2.0 to be installed. It will automatically take the 2.0 compiled application and run on 4.0. Actually, this thing starts blinking all over the time. I don't press a button, and it automatically advances. So I'm going to unplug this thing. So this is rubbish. Good. So this is basically what's happening there. This actually means, as I said, that, you know, if you only have .NET 4.0 installed, what we do is we see all the imports in the reference table of the assembly, saying, for example, MS CoreLib version 2, and we basically rewrite that to be MS CoreLib v4, and it automatically goes, you know, to the new version of the runtime there. So that's something you can do. Now, in addition to out-of-process side-by-side, meaning that you have different versions of the CLR sitting next to each other, we can now also have multiple versions of the CLR in the same process. And this was historically a problem. Like, if people were writing, like, shell extensions using .NET, well, you're opening yourself to lots of trouble. Because, like, when I open Notepad and I do file open, I'm actually loading shell extensions at that point in time, because that's a common dialogue. This means that, you know, if you have a shell extension using .NET 2.0, at that point you're injecting CLR 2.0 in the notepad.exe process space. Now, if somebody else tries to do something with CLR 1.1, things start breaking because the two CLRs cannot live in the same process space. So we had to do something about that because if you want to write, for example, Outlook add-ins, well, it doesn't make sense that everyone is going to use either only .NET 2.0 add-ins or only .NET 4.0 add-ins. So we need to have some side-by-side story there. And so that's what we've done with CLR 4.0. It's now possible to basically have both the CLR 2.0 with the whole stack on top of that, as well as .NET 4.0 with its stack, basically sitting in the same address space. So the garbage collector uses different heaps, the JIT compiler uses different memory regions. They don't see each other at all. Like if, for example, you do application domains, give me all the application domains, or you discover threads or whatever, you won't see them from the other CLR and vice versa. They're truly isolated. So if you want to cross the boundary between the two CLRs, well, you have to use some communication mechanism like named pipes or WCF or whatever. So actually, I want to give you a very small demo of some side-by-side stuff. I'll actually start by taking a look at the runtime side-by-side. So everyone knows that if you have runtime side by side, we have different folders of the framework sitting under the Microsoft .NET Framework folder. That hasn't changed at all, so now we have the V4 folder. One thing that has changed a little bit is the fact that the global assembly cache is also split. And the reason we do that is to make sure that CLR 2.0 not accidentally sees 4.0 assemblies and vice versa. So we had to do something to sort of keep the GEC separate. There's an additional reason for this, because the original GEC, C Windows Assembly, actually lived under the Windows folder. It was controlled by the operating system and quite some primitives. Actually, Vista and Windows 7 know exactly about this folder and apply quite some protection to it. So, you know, in order to reshuffle a couple of things and to have true splitting between the global assembly caches, the 4.0 assembly cache actually lives under Windows Microsoft .NET Assembly. And there we actually have, you know, exactly the same layout as the global assembly cache had before. We don't have a shell extension for the GEC in this particular location anymore. So, you know, you can simply browse the folders. If you want to mess with it, well, you know, you can go ahead, but you have to use GECutil as the supported way to add stuff to the GEC. So if you're looking for the GEC at some point, you know, in the raw folder structure, that's where it lives in 4.0. Now, besides of that, I also want to show you the in-process side-by-side. This sample is, you know, the most boring thing I could come up with in some sense. What I'm doing here is I'm using the iCore MetaHost API. You can actually just find that in the header files of the Windows SDK. That's a new hosting API for the CLR we actually have, so you can actually load the CLR in your process. And it's called MetaHost because, you know, you can actually deal with multiple versions. Like, it's the API that deals with multiple versions of the CLR. So I'm just going to prove the point that you can load multiple CLRs in the same process. So I have some little tool here that we wrote internally to do some testing of running add-ins, Outlook add-ins in the same process, one that's compiled against 2.0, one compiled against 4.0. So that's the side-by-side hosting tool that uses all those public APIs, and I can basically ask the API for all the versions of the CLR installed on the machine. This doesn't go to 1.1 and 1.0. Those actually have a different loading mechanism that we no longer support by the meta hosting APIs. So it does 2.0, 4.0, and everything beyond will actually be supported by this API. And actually, the side-by-side story only applies to 2.0 and 4.0 in the same process. So that's what we have here. We see all the versions of the CLR. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to open this nice little tool, Process Explorer. I'm going to find my side-by-side host, and I'm going to try to load a couple of versions of the CLR here. So the only thing you will actually see here is some green lines appearing as assemblies are being loaded or modules are being loaded. So I'm going to load the 2.0 CLR. Again, I'm just invoking the underlying, you know, meta hosting APIs, and in reality, you wouldn't have to do that because you would be sitting in Outlook, you would be loading a 2.0 add-in, and it would just, you know, load the CLR for you because it by itself is already a CLR host. So as I do that, you see that, you know, there was something appearing here on the screen, which is mscoreworks.dll, and mscoreworks.dll is CLR version 2.0. It still has that WKS behind it to say that it's a workstation version. In 4.0, we just have one CLR, and that will be called CLR.dll, which I will be loading now. So I'm going to say load V4 in the same process space. And so here you see CLR.dll being loaded in the same process. And now I could actually throw assemblies at those guys, and they will execute in the same address space, well, in the same, you know, process space, but, you know, they will be truly isolated from one another. So I promised you this demo is just, you know, proving the point that it's possible. So it's kind of boring, but, you know, that's, you know, just enough to prove the point about side-by-side compatibility. Now, next, I want to talk a little bit about primary interop assemblies. As we all know, early on in the design of .NET, it was decided it was pretty important to have the ability to reach out to existing pieces of code. So, for example, COM automation, you know, PInvoke, all of those things were actually built into the runtime very early on. And in fact, we have huge support for those kind of scenarios, as testified by, for example, you know, Adam Nathan's book on .NET interoperability, which is 1,500 pages. So there's quite some stuff to be told there. Now, it turns out that, you know, today in .NET 4.0, we are still seeing lots of COM APIs being developed. Like, for example, in the Office team, the Windows team, those people, you know, have a background in COM, and, you know, they're continue to investing in those things. So we need to do something to make it easier for people to reach out to those technologies. And in .NET 4.0, we're sort of, you know, redoing part of the work that we did before with the primary interop assemblies. So primary interop assemblies, very briefly, are basically, you know, the blessed interop assemblies for a certain product, but they bring some kind of problems with them, like, you know, versioning becomes kind of hard, and also deployment is non-trivial because, like, you know, I'm using just the Word APIs, and I'm just using three methods of them. Why do I have to redistribute, like, a 4 megabyte primary interop assembly file with my application? Well, that doesn't really make sense. And they're also kind of hard to create, so there are lots of challenges here. Now, in order to do that interop yourself, like if you are in the position that you need to expose a COM API or a Windows API or just a raw C API, we have some new tools actually on this website. I just want to point this out. It's actually compatible with 3.5 and older releases as well. So we have some tools there that automatically generate pinvoke signatures and all of that stuff. So that's just an additional side note. But now on to the PIA thing. One solution to solve the PIA problem is to say, well, let's get rid of the PIAs. Well, not completely, but, you know, sort of have an initiative that we can basically eliminate, you know, all the hard points that PIAs actually have. So one thing we do there is in collaboration between the languages and the CLR, we have something called NoPIA, which actually embodies things like the embedding of interop types in your own assemblies. Now, what does that mean? Well, if you're using just a couple of methods from a certain interface in Word, what we actually do at compile time is we basically suck in that interface into your own assembly. Now, if somebody else does that, you know, for its assembly and uses different functionality, you will get different, you know, imports of interfaces and methods on those interfaces. So you basically get pay for play. You're only paying for the pieces you're using, and you don't need to redistribute the primary interop assemblies with your application anymore. Now, behind the scenes, we need to do some stuff in the runtime in order to make this work. One of the things we need to do is called type equivalence. Let me actually sketch, you know, a pretty simple scenario. Say that you have some application and you have two assemblies, and both of those assemblies are using, you know, the interop assemblies. And one is saying, well, I'm going to use the document interface of Word, and I'm going to use the save as method and the print method. And then some other guy is saying, well, I'm also using the document interface to run the spell checker. So now you have two copies of that interface that are both embedded using NoPIA in your own assembly, but I told you that they only embed the portions that you're using. So, you know, one will have a document interface with two methods in it, which are different from the other one using a document interface with different methods in it. Now, if those two assemblies meet and you have an object that's basically an instance of the one interface, like it has that type, it should be compatible with the other one because originally they were the same interface. We're both talking about the document interface, but we're just interested in different aspects of that interface. So we need to have assignment compatibility and all of that stuff, and that's stuff that actually happens at the CLR level with things called type equivalence. So the thing that actually happens is that when we import those interfaces, we clone them into your assembly just in a partial manner, just the pieces you're using, we stick some attribute on top of it called type identifier that says, well, this interface is really the same as that interface over there. It looks totally different, but, you know, we're talking about the same thing. So it's type safe to do assignments across because, you know, at runtime, the layout will actually be determined by doing COM interop using iDispatch and all of those, you know, nasty things under the covers. And in order to accommodate that a little further, we also need to communicate to the CLR how many, you know, gaps there are in dispatching tables and so forth. So we also have something called vtable gaps to make this work. Now, in practice, this feature is on by default. If you import a primary interop assembly, now you will see some option there in the properties called embed interop types. If you set that thing to true, which is the default, it will actually pass the /link flag to the C# or the VB compiler, passing in that assembly, and the compiler will basically suck in all the things you're using into your own assembly. So you don't have a runtime reference to the primary interop assembly anymore. So here I have a very simple sample of that. I'm using the active document interface. I'm just using the save method. So what happens is that we basically synthesize this particular interface into your own assembly, just using the portions that you are using. So we have the save method there. We have a type identifier on it so that we can have assignment if somebody else uses the same, you know, underscore document interface with different methods. And we also have some vtable gap to tell the CLR, well, you know, there are some holes here. If you want to do dispatch, you need to keep some things in mind. So that's an implementation detail, really. So let me actually show you Nopia in practice. It's, a very simple sample, but just proving the point here. So what I have is an application that basically uses the Word Automation APIs. It's, again, the document interface. It uses some different stuff than the ones I actually have in the slide. I think it's already loaded here. It's over here. So I'm just using the visible property. Visible equals true, nothing else. So if I go to the references, Microsoft Office Intro Word, I've actually changed the default, which by default now is true, to false. So that's the old story, like how it behaved in .NET 3.5. If I compile this and I open the thing in Reflector, what I will basically see is in the references, I have a reference to the assembly called Microsoft Office Interop Word, which means that you have the burden to redistribute this assembly with your application. Now, if I go back here and I change this thing to true and I recompile, again, I go to Reflector. Now what you will see is that in the references, I don't have a reference to Microsoft Office Interop Word anymore. But instead, that interface, or that, you know, namespace with some of the interfaces has been copied into your own assembly. Now, you see that something more is copied here because, you know, it just so happens that in the world of COM, people use interfaces all over the place. And, you know, application implements application events 4, and 4 implements 3, and so forth. So we need to copy a little bit more to have the full layout at runtime of the interfaces. But again, I'm not using anything from, you know, application events 2, so you won't even find any single member in this particular thing. It's just sitting there as a stub, just enough to make it work. And so if I take a look at underscore application, you see I'm only using, you know, the visible property here. It always has a getter and a setter. And, you know, we have a vtable gap that says that there are 26 methods omitted from the start of the vtable, and then we have actually this visible property. So that's all the information the runtime needs in order to still make it work. And so that's the way actually Nopia works. One more thing I should say about this is you can basically check whether two types are equivalent, meaning that they have the type identifier attribute and they really represent the same underlying, you know, object type by doing, you know, like it doesn't work for an int, of course, because it's not an interop type. I could better do, you know, word or the application or something. But say that you have a system.type, you can ask is equivalent to, and you pass in a different type, and it will say true if they are type equivalent, and it will say false, of course, if they are not. So that's essentially the essence of PIA, is just this particular thing, which is on by default. So let's continue. As I promised at the beginning, it's all about making the C in Common Language Runtime bigger. And COM Interop is one of those things because, you know, you want to reach out to more domains and, you know, with less friction. And that's something we enable using Nopia. Now, in the language landscape, we also have, you know, more challenges ahead. Now, how many have heard about Project 7? Nobody. Okay. Either I'm getting old and in reality I'm not. But so Project 7 was something that was run very early on in the 2000s, basically to make sure that the C in Common Language Runtime was not a lie, making sure that multiple languages could really run on top of the CLR. So we had 7 academic and 7 industrial languages basically being built on top of the Common Language Runtime. 7 plus 7, as you can see, adds up to 16 for some reason. So at some point, you know, somebody overachieved and implemented 2 more compilers. But so initially when the CLR launched, we had 16 different languages on top of the runtime. Now today, we have much more of those, in fact, but we also see 2 big trends sort of coming along. One is dynamic languages like Ruby and Python are getting quite some attention, as well as JavaScript. And we also have functional languages entering, you know, scientific communities, banking institutes, you know, love functional programming because code is more concise, certain algorithms get much easier to express in there thanks to, you know, things like pattern matching, whatnot. So those are 2 big trends that we're sort of seeing. So what do we have to do in the runtime to support those? And the answer is we didn't have to do a whole lot of things. The runtime is already quite mature to support those. But there were a couple of little things we should do anyway. So first of all, if those languages have new common concepts, we need to make sure that they talk the same language. Not languages and programming language, but if one actually has a tuple, for example, which is just a pair or a triplet of different values, and you have that thing in Python, and all of a sudden you interoperate with F#, it should be the same thing, right? Because otherwise they will be confused. They don't have any agreement on how tuple types actually look like. So we had to introduce, for example, a tuple type in order to support this particular thing. Then we also see lots of languages taking, you know, advantage of, you know, not taking advantage of the CPU in the sense of it's 32-bit or 64-bit, but they say, well, numbers are just numbers. There's no restriction on that thing. I just want unlimited precision integer arithmetic. So F# and Python, for example, say, you know, we just want big integers. Now, in order for those things to interoperate, we need to make sure that we have some common type. So we work together with the Microsoft Solver Foundation people, which are, you know, big mathematicians sitting in dark rooms, basically, you know, implementing big integers and complex types and all of that stuff. So we have that in .NET 4.0 as well. And then we also had to do some work in the JIT compiler for x64 to optimize something called tail recursion. That's something functional languages use quite a bit. In tail recursion, basically, your method calls itself at the very end. And beyond the point it calls itself, it doesn't have to use anything in the stack frame anymore. So we can reuse the stack frame. We don't run, you know, in stack overflow situations, even though you have unbounded recursion. Now, for x64, certain optimizations were not present in the JIT compiler, so we did that. And, you know, if you actually type code like this in F#, you're actually using tail recursion functionality in the framework. So, you know, if you write this stuff in F#, just think about how good the JIT compiler people were to, you know, not overflow your stack anymore. Now, some other BCL features that I've outlined here, and I will actually give a demo of a couple of those. In the system namespace, we have lazy of t, which is a lazily computed function. So you basically give it a way to compute a value. It doesn't compute it unless you do dot value on the thing, and then it will basically trigger the computation, caching the result, you know, once and for all. So that's something to do lazy computations. In system numerics, as I told before, we have big integer and we have the complex number. In the system I/O namespace, we have memory mapped files, which is just a tiny layer on top of the Win32 APIs. We have some new collection types, and we have various enhancements to even, you know, the most primitive types like the string type. We've done some stuff, you know, to make certain uses easier. Like, for example, I use string.join all the time together with link queries, where I say I have a link query that produces, you know, 10 strings, and I want to comma separate them. Well, in the past, I had to do string.join, comma, and then your query, and I had to do two array on the thing. Now you no longer have to do that because we also have overloads that take an IEnumerable of string in this particular case. So you will find lots of those little methods being added to the BCL. So a few samples of some of the BCL types. Oh, I don't want the window menu. So here, first of all, I'm showing you the tuple type. The tuple type is statically typed. It's basically, you know, it has all the type information you can dream of. And we have a couple of overloads of this. Well, it's not really called overloads if you're talking about generics, but we have up to 8 generic parameters on tuples. So you can actually have, you know, a pair, a triplet, you know, and so forth. And there is also the convention that if you want more, then languages will basically nest those tuples. They will say, I'm going to use a tuple with 7 things, and the 8th thing will be a tuple by itself. So you can sort of nest those things to be arbitrarily long. And since we have this common language now, that both, in this case, Python and F# are using, they can basically just, you know, have a tuple on one side and basically assign it to a language construct on the other side. So for example, if I would feed this thing to F#, in F#, I would be able to write something like A comma B equals tuple, and then that will mean that A gets bound to Bart, like this, and that, you know, B, oh my God, that, well, you know what I mean, B will get bound to 27. So basically, that pattern matching functionality is built on top of tuples, but you know, different languages use exactly the same underlying types. Now, in C#, we don't have any syntax to decompose tuples just yet. Maybe in a future release, we will have something like, you know, tuple.1 or tuple, you know, whatever, like number 1 to basically index into tuples, or maybe just using indexing syntax. But you can use those guys from inside C# as well by using the item properties. So it's an anonymous thing because it's just, you know, packaging up different values. But you know, if you have some language that actually exposes those things, at least you can interoperate with those values as well. So in this case, I'm basically decomposing it. And then below, I'm actually showing the big integer type. In order to use that one, you will actually have to add a reference to system numerics, which just lives in the .NET Framework tab on the reference dialog. And so here, I'm basically computing factorial of 10,000, which is just impossible to do with 64-bit or 32-bit arithmetic, but you know, with big integer, we can just do it. I'm just using, you know, a recursive algorithm here, starting with 1 and then just, you know, multiplying all the individual values. So if I execute this, now it's possible in a very efficient way to compute those big numbers. It looks pretty impressive as wallpaper, in my opinion. So now you can do all of that stuff. So very nice. Now, besides of that, we also have a complex type. So, you know, if you go to the Solver Foundation guys and say, we want a complex type, they take a big mathematics book and basically say, we're going to implement all of that stuff, even, you know, the most exotic things I've never heard about. So the complex type is sitting here. And so there you have, like, some static methods, like, you know, the things that the math class also has, but in this case for complex numbers. So you have things like complex conjugate. You even have conversions from polar coordinates, all of that stuff. And so you can basically create those new complex numbers very easily, like, for example, 1 real and 2 imaginary. And you can do, you know, all sorts of operations because they, of course, have operator overloads available on them. So, and the print form is just a pair. So 1,2 means, you know, 1 real and 2 imaginary. And again, that's something, because different languages actually support that, we need to make sure that they speak the same language so that we can make sure that the interoperability is not hurt by it. Good. Actually, I want to show something else, because I have, you know, 10 minutes more than previous conferences. I actually have some time to show you memory mapped I.O. as well. So let me do that. So the memory mapped I.O. lives in the system I.O. namespace. It's sort of, you know, traditional that in every release we add something to that namespace. Like at some point we added named pipes and, you know, and compression was added in some release as well. Now this time around we did memory mapped files. So that's the namespace to find memory mapped I.O. in. And it has just a couple of things there. So you have a memory mapped file. You have some concept of a stream and an accessor. I'm just going to explain those concepts very briefly. So a memory mapped file you can do a couple of things with. You can either create one which is purely in memory. You can say, I want something in memory that in reality, you know, will just be lazily used in some sense. And you say, I want something that's a terabyte large and I just want a window over a certain portion of that and just stick things into that, for example. So you can basically do create new here, and then you can create such a thing just, you know, for in-memory use. You can also create one from a file. Like, for example, if you say I have an executable file, and I know that at position 1500 in the file, something interesting lives, well, you can map that thing into address space. That's actually what the kernel does here. And it basically creates a window over the position that you want to look at, and then you can basically use streams and all of that stuff to access that portion of the file. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to use some in-memory stuff. I'm going to say, you know, create new, and I'm going to give it a name. I'm just going to give it name test. I'm going to say create something which is, you know, quite large. So here I have my memory mapped file. Let me actually just call that thing MMF, okay, like this, and import the namespace. So now on the memory mapped file, you can do two things. You can either say, I want to have a stream over that, which is just, you know, any single, you know, system I.O. stream. It's the same concepts, begin, read, end, read, all of that stuff. You can also create an accessor over this thing, which provides some more, you know, intelligent ways to do things. I will actually show that in just a second. But so first I'm going to use a stream. And I'm going to say I want to skip ahead 1500 into that memory mapped file, and I want to map in 8 bytes. So basically, I have a little window over that file, and that's my stream. I cannot go out of the bounds of that. I'm just, you know, locked within that thing. So that gives me a stream, which I will call MMS, and I will do just some write operation to it. This is just the stream interface, and I will put some bytes in there. So let me actually put a byte array there of 8 long, and it will contain, 1 and 2. So I'm basically using, you know, int32s here that I just manually put into 4 single bytes. For some reason, this thing is complaining. I likely need an offset as well into that array. So it's asking me, yes, where to start copying in that array and how much elements to copy. So 0.8 is what I need. So here I'm just using the streaming APIs, but I could also have, you know, some other consumer, like MMC as the consumer, that basically will open that same file from somewhere else in the code, and it will actually say, I want to open an existing file, and that file will be called test. Okay. And now this guy might actually say, well, I don't want to use the streaming APIs. Instead, I want to use the accessor APIs. And those actually provide some very interesting functionality. So I'm going to create a view accessor. Again, you know, skipping to position 1500.8. So I'm at the same point in that file. And I'm going to call that memory mapped accessor. And now I can do things like memory mapped accessor.read. And you see it's a generic. So you can basically pass in a struct here that has the layout of that data in memory, and we'll basically, you know, stuff it into that struct in memory. So for example, if you know from a C header or something that at a certain position in a file, something follows a certain in-memory structure, you can basically map that onto an instance of that structure. So, and that's the reason I actually did 1,000 and 2,000, because that's actually the layout of 2 ints in memory, which could be, you know, a struct called a point, which has a public int x and a public int y. That's exactly the same layout in memory, you know, with our 8 bytes, 4 for one and 4 for the other, and it uses, you know, some particular memory layout here. So I'm going to say I want to read a point from a certain position, you know, relative to where my accessor is. So I will just do 0 here. I'm already at position 1500. And I want to put that thing into a point, which will be point PT. And so now I'm sort of, you know, looking at that little piece of memory through the lenses of a struct, and I basically get that value assigned to PT. And so I have a consumer and a producer. The producer actually used the stream. The consumer is using the accessor APIs. And so I get a point here that contains 1,2. So in C, you would do something very similar. You would do an allocation of some piece in memory, you know, size of the struct, and then basically assign it. It's basically exactly the same functionality, but now in the system.io namespace. So if you need to interoperate with those kind of things, well, you know, memory mapped.io is there to help you. So dynamic languages, as I mentioned before, needed to do some stuff to support those in terms of, you know, the common functionality that they support, like tuple types and all of that. But besides of that, we also need to have some core functionality to, you know, embody the dynamic dispatch behavior of dynamic languages. Basically means that you don't have compile time types. You basically want to search for things at runtime. And so the DLR actually provides all the functionality to do so. Now, there are 3 core facilities in the DLR. One is called expression trees, which people might have heard about in .NET 3.5. That's basically an API that allows you to create code as data. You basically say, I want to have an if statement, and it has this condition expression, and this condition expression compares 2 ints, and, you know, it does this and that. So you basically describe that thing by newing up an object, and then you can give it to the DLR, which is basically what languages do, and the DLR can turn it into IL code to execute. So that's basically what the DLR does there. And it uses lightweight code generation behind the scenes, system reflection emit to do so. Besides that, we also have dynamic dispatch, meaning, well, if you have a calculator object that comes from somewhere, maybe it comes from Python, maybe it comes from JavaScript, well, you need to dynamically dispatch operations to it because you don't have a compile time type. So at runtime, you need to take a look, well, does this thing support an add method that takes in 1,2, and then the DLR does some communication and finds out, yes, it's the case, or no, it is not the case. And then call-side caching basically optimizes the invocation of dynamic operations if you do them all over again. Like, if once you're using a calculator dynamically and you feed it two integers, well, the next time we already know how to call the calculator with two integers. We can reuse the code that we generated for that, and that's what call-side caching actually does. Now, on top of that, of course, we have a whole range of languages like, you know, Python and Ruby, but also C#. With C# 4.0, the dynamic keyword actually supports the DLR. VB.NET is in the same boat, and this is all, you know, open documented interfaces that we're using there, so other languages can also party on the dynamic language runtime. And on the other side, you know, it's an N times M matrix in some sense. We have N languages, we have M targets. You can basically talk to lots of things, like you can talk to, you know, plain CLR objects using dynamic. You can also talk to, for example, JavaScript with certain binders in Silverlight, and even in WPF we have some properties sitting for XBabs, you know, the browser applications. We have something exposed as dynamic, so you can basically dot into JavaScript from inside C#. We have Python and Ruby, actually, of course, as targets for dynamic, and we also have the COM binder. So if you're using iDispatch through COM interop facilities, well, we can use some of the infrastructure of the DLR to make that, you know, even better as well. So, in essence, what we've done here is we've sort of extended the CLR and the BCL with additional functionality to support dynamic. So in 2.0, we sort of did the hard work. There we have things like, you know, lightweight code generation. System reflection emit allows you to create code at runtime. You say, I want a NOP instruction, I want this instruction, that instruction. You compile it at runtime, and you can invoke it. So that's actually what we did in .NET 2.0. In 3.5, again, there were no CLR enhancements or core enhancements, so it was mainly about language features, like C# 3.0 had, you know, support for expression trees. So you had a nice way in C# to create those guys if you really wanted to. Now, on top of that, in .NET 4.0, and those were actually part of the link release wave, in .NET 4.0, we did all the stuff in the DLR, and actually we did something more. We did something called collectible assemblies in the garbage collector. So, for example, if you go to a dynamic language like Iron Python, and you basically new up some type here, you can just do that ad hoc. You can say, I want a class calculator, and it needs to have an add method that, you know, has a this parameter that just means it's an instance method. It takes in an A and a B, and it returns A plus B. Now, I have created just a type on the fly, and that thing uses the DLR inside. Basically, what Iron Python does, it looks at, you know, your code, it parses and lexes and all of that stuff. It creates a tree, and ultimately it tells the DLR, here is an expression tree that describes all the operations in a calculator type. So at runtime, we basically generated a type of that thing, and I can, of course, instantiate the thing, and I can do C at 1,2, and it will work. So I've just compiled at runtime some code. But it might be the case that I'm not interested in that calculator at some point anymore. Those things can be scoped and whatnot, and at some point it might just be unreachable. You might not be able to use the calculator type anymore. Now, in the past you were stuck because the CLR doesn't allow you to get rid of code that's generated inside an app domain. You have to get rid of the entire app domain. Now, in .NET 4.0, we actually have collectible assemblies for dynamically generated code, which means that this calculator type could go away if, you know, it's not being used anymore or not usable by Python. So basically, we can collect pieces of code that were dynamically generated. Now, this doesn't hold for regular assemblies. You can't do something like assembly.unload out of an app domain. It only works for dynamically generated code. So we have that thing there because, you know, if you're sitting in a REPL loop, a read evaluation print loop, for the whole day, and you're sort of creating new types and throwing things away, well, you don't want to leak, you know, memory for things that you're not using anymore. So there is some garbage collector facility for code as well. So actually, with that, and in the future, actually, on top of the DLR, we'll likely have much more services like, you know, the C# compiler as a service, as most likely Anders has alluded to as well. So concerning C# 4.0 and dynamic, very briefly, I'm going to show it in a sample and show how it works, essentially. So here I have some piece of code which is statically typed. It basically knows exactly that you have a calculator type, And hence, the compiler can check that when you call the add method, it's just fine to do so with two ints because it's compatible. Now, if you don't have a compile time type, somebody gave you a calculator and you don't even have an interface for the thing, or you don't have, you know, a public type that you can cast your object to, it's impossible to call the add method because the compiler doesn't know even that there is an add method available. So instead, you have to do all sorts of hoops using reflection to get into that thing. Now, yet in other domains, like, for example, you might be reaching out to JavaScript and some genius has said, well, you know, to do dynamic invocation, we have this plain sexy API called invoke, and it takes in a parameter rate. That's very nice. But knowing one doesn't help you to understand the other. Like, there is no unification in the domains on how to do dynamic. So in 4.0, we have this dynamic keyword, which basically, you know, tells the compiler statically that something has to be dispatched at runtime, which is called dynamic. So, you know, the compiler has all the information about generating code that at runtime will look for an add method instead of doing it at compile time. So here I have a dynamic method invocation. Because calc is typed dynamically, it means that the compiler should not look for an add method that's compatible. That whole decision is deferred till runtime. And similarly, if that calculator comes back at some point and says, you know, the result is 30, well, that's the runtime type, you know, it's an int32 at runtime, but the compiler doesn't know that add will return something that's compatible with an int. So again, there needs to be some dialogue with the DLR to say, hey, I got 30 back, is this compatible with an int? And, you know, the calculator add might actually return some type that comes from Python, like you might do add of, you know, 1 million and 2 trillion, and it will return a big integer, and you're assigning it to an int over here. Well, you have to sort of go to the DLR to ask, well, is that compatible with, you know, an int32? And the answer will be no in that particular case. So that's actually where those dialogues are happening. So let me actually show behind the scenes a little bit more how dynamic works very, very briefly. So for demo is on dynamic. I'm pretty sure you've seen the calculator because it's, you know, the typical sample that we use all over the place. But now I'm going to take a look behind the scenes. Now, first of all, I should, you know, show three samples of code here that use a calculator. So the first one uses it statically, which means that I have a calculator type somewhere, like it's sitting here. And when I declare a variable of type calc, when I do the dot operator on it, it basically knows that there is an add method, and the add method takes in two ints, and if I violate that contract, it won't compile. Everyone knows how that works. Now, instead, I could also assign that thing to dynamic. But that's something you wouldn't do if you have the compile time type. Like, this is bad practice, you shouldn't be doing this. But I'm just showing you, you know, exactly the same code, but now dynamically typed. The difference is that you're basically saying to the compiler, don't look at that right-hand side, you know, this calc thing is statically typed to be dynamic. That means defer all the decisions you would make at runtime. At runtime, you will find an add method, please believe me, but don't check for it at compile time. So hence, you know, since there's nothing happening at compile time, if you do the dot operator on this thing, it will say this operation will be resolved at runtime. So we can't help you with IntelliSense because, you know, we don't have a compile time type for the thing. Now, ultimately, this thing will return something. I'm, you know, assigning it to a static type again, and I'm back in the statically typed world where, you know, I can dot on two objects. Now here, I also do the same with Iron Python. So I'm hosting Python inside my C-sharp application. It's the calculator I wrote before. And again, you know, to call the add method on that different language, I can basically use dynamic. So I'm importing that whole calculator file as a dynamic, which means I can just call into all the operations that are defined in there using the dot operator. So on the scope, which is the entire script block, I can do dot get calc. This thing will create a new calculator that's the same as this syntax in C#. In Python, you just write this thing. And then on the calculator instance, I can call the add method. And again, you know, I can simply use the dot operator. So this piece of code looks exactly the same regardless of what you're talking to. Am I talking to a statically typed object, a dynamically typed CLR object, JavaScript, Python, you know, whatever. Now, how does this thing work? I'm just going to show you the essence of the packaging that's happening. Like I told you that the compiler basically, you know, sees that there is an add method, so it captures all of that information so that at runtime it can go and look for is there an add method available. So it just defers that till runtime. So if I go into Reflector, I can actually show you the code that gets generated for this. So if I go to my program and to the static piece of code, in static, you know, you just see calc.add, which means the compiler exactly knew which method to call at compile time. Like Reflector in this case only knows about C# 3.0, so it won't decompile the 4.0 specific code. So for that reason, I can actually use Reflector here. Now, if I basically go to dynamic, which is exactly the same code, but, you know, using calc typed as dynamic, I get this whole piece of code here. Now, let me actually put it in something that gives me a little bit more, you know, font size. I'm not going into all the details of this thing, but I'm just going to show you one thing. What's happening here is the compiler is creating a call site. So just, you know, squint and sort of cast away, you know, all the things I'm not focusing on here. So I have a call site, and that call site is a cache. That basically means that if I do an add operation on the calculator with 1,2, that cache will actually learn how to do 1,2 and add it together, because the DLR will, you know, figure out how to do it. It will give back some expression tree that gets compiled into, you know, an efficient code path that can do 1+2. Now, if that call site at some point, you know, gets, you know, two different inputs, it will learn about those inputs as well. So it's sort of learning on how to add two things together, two ints, to, you know, a datetime and a time span. All of that stuff gets cached in the call site, so that subsequent calls gets faster. Now, so we create a call site, and that call site also knows what it's supposed to do. Like in this case, I need to call an add method, so the call site contains an invocation instruction, so that's basically the DLR lingo for an invocation. So we're saying we want to do an invocation. It's called add, so you see it gets packaged up as a string. So at runtime, we basically see the user wrote ADD, and that's the thing we need to look for. And then it has some additional flags. It has some flags like from which type you're trying to call this, so that we can actually enforce visibility. Like if you try to call a private thing from a different type from inside program, we need to know you're crossing type boundaries, and private modifier means you can't do that. So we actually need to communicate where this call site lives. And we have additional information about, you know, the things that we saw. Like we saw a constant for the first argument because I was doing add 1,2. So all of that information gets packaged up. And then, you know, at runtime, the DLR can take a look at the intent of the user and basically check for things dynamically, whether or not there is something that basically can do this operation. Now, to show that call site optimization very briefly, I can basically do something like this. Like in Iron Python, if I would do, you know, a for loop for int I equals 0, I is lower than 10, I plus plus, and I would basically, you know, just call my calculator adding numbers together like this, you know, I comma I, whatever, that returns some result. Then, you know, only the first time we do that add call with two integer type parameters, we'll do all the lookup to find is there an add method that's compatible. And as soon as we know that, the call site will have learned about that, and subsequent calls will be faster. So it gets faster in this particular case than doing, you know, dynamic invocations yourself using, you know, all the Python APIs. Or if you're using Reflection, well, you know, it optimizes beyond the point that Reflection would be able to optimize. So the first time, you know, this thing will have taken a little longer than the other guys. And similarly, you know, if I'm using that same add method here, and I would basically be doing something like this, add a datetime, datetime.now, and add a time span to it from days I, like this. So just add some days to it, and that will be, you know, the future, and that thing will return a datetime. Again, the call site will learn about how to add a datetime and a time span. It will just do the expensive lookup once, and then subsequent times it will go faster. And because Python is dynamically typed, I can call add between datetime.now and time span. Could even do an add between two strings, because, you know, in Python you can simply do that. So again, you know, the call site optimization lives in that call site object. I have some blog posts on the topic on how it exactly works. It basically, you know, generates IL code on the fly that it rewrites every time it learns some new facts. So it basically literally gets into code that looks like, you know, if the first argument, if arg1 is an int32, and, well, not that syntax, but arg2 is an int32, then we're actually going to use this code to do the dispatch. So that's basically the code that gets generated at runtime for every single combination of inputs. And if that table gets too large, we actually will fall back to a dictionary to make the lookup even more efficient. So that's basically a sneak peek behind the scenes of Dynamic. So a little bit more about, you know, optimizations for performance. You know, in Dynamic, we try to do our very best to make things as performant as possible. But of course, we can do also more stuff in the runtime, not only for the Dynamic scenario, but for other scenarios as well. So there are a couple of important challenges ahead with regards to multi-core CPUs. So we need to have some, you know, better programmability story to basically deal with those. And this is a slide that everyone uses nowadays. You know, Moore's law means number of transistors on a chip is doubling every 2 years. Well, today it's more the case that, you know, the number of cores is doubling every 2 years. Like, this is a dual core. At work I have a quad core, and some people are, you know, ordering their 8 cores today, and, you know, it will continue to grow that way. So what can we do to improve speed? A couple of things. First of all, we can do some stuff in the garbage collector to take advantage of, you know, new hardware in order to make, you know, collections faster. So a very sneak peek, you know, at how the garbage collector works. That's some, you know, stuff that has been there for ages. We have two segments, an ephemeral segment and the other segments. Ephemeral typically contains, you know, the short-lived objects, which are generation 0 and 1. Those are rather small, so objects start in generation 0. If they survive, they move to generation 1, which is slightly bigger. And if they even survive that, you know, they're beyond their midlife crisis, as we say, it moves into, you know, generation 2. So in generation 2, everything comes together that, you know, is long-lived. So that generation can be quite big. We've actually seen heaps of several gigabytes, you know, on certain web servers or, you know, certain server scenarios where you just have, you know, objects that tend to long. That's not a typical case for web servers, but, you know, there are applications that basically cause generation 2 to be quite big. And, you know, a multi-gigabyte, you know, generation 2, it exists, and if we have to collect that and you're the unlucky user just hitting that particular scenario, you will actually have a noticeable pause in your application because we have to, you know, churn through, like, multiple gigabytes of heap. So in CLR4.0, we're doing a couple of things to make the scenario better. We actually did something in 3.5 SP1 that we've extended upon in CLR4.0 that's called the Generation 2 notifications. And we also have something in the workstation GC, which is called background collection. So let's actually go into those a little bit. So the server GC notification APIs is something you can use if you're in the scenario that you don't want long pauses to slow down users. So for example, if you have huge workloads on some server and you have multiple servers that could actually handle requests, well, you could basically watch out for a full collection to come, and if that's the case, basically offload traffic to a different server while that collection will be going on. And so that's where you use actually the server GC notification APIs for. That basically looks like this. So first of all, you have to call some function that says, you know, I'm interested to be notified if there is a full GC approaching. And then ultimately, on a separate thread, you will basically do some polling. This is not a busy loop. It actually just blocks, you know, wait for full GC approach. Will basically block till, you know, such an approach is actually happening. And then, you know, if you successfully waited on that thing, sometimes it can return for other reasons, so you have to check that it succeeded. You can basically, you know, talk to other infrastructure in your network or, you know, other infrastructure even on your server, because you might have multiple .NET applications running alongside each other. And you can basically, you know, do something to make sure that no new requests get routed to your application, because there is some GC to be approached, and that GC might take a long time. So you can basically load balance traffic off this particular server. Once this approach is actually happening, you're basically going to wait for the full GC to complete. And so as soon as the full GC completes, you can basically restore traffic to that particular server. So that's basically something that the customer actually has implemented in his web infrastructure to basically accommodate for those scenarios. So that's the full collection approach, notifications in server GC. Now the workstation GC, up till .NET 3.5 SP1, had something called concurrent GC. And one of the artifacts of concurrent GC is that high latency peaks are possible if you have huge generation 2s. So in this particular case, what you're seeing is like, you know, a peak somewhere in the application because of some allocation patterns. And, you know, again, you know, because of different languages entering the CLR, we see different allocation patterns coming along. Like, for example, an F-sharp application will typically have short-lived objects all over the place because it's immutable. Like, the slightest change to an object creates a whole new object, so it will be all short-lived. But then you have other languages that tend, you know, to create long-lived objects or, you know, it's basically the case that, you know, you mutate objects in place and you just keep holding on to the existing memory. So in certain cases, you know, you could have high latency peaks here, like, you know, a peak of, you know, in this particular case, a second. Now what we do actually, and there is something wrong with my slide layout here, it's called background GC in .NET 4. In .NET 4, what we can do is, because we can take advantage of new hardware and all of that stuff, we actually have done the work to have generation 0 and 1 collections in the ephemeral segment working at the same time as generation 2 collections. So basically, because generation 2 is in a separate, you know, address space in some sense, it's in the extended segment, we can basically do things in parallel while we're wasting time doing stuff in generation 0 and 1 anyway. Like we can say, oh, while this thing is happening, we can do some cleanup in generation 2 as well. And so the result of that is that we, for one thing, we actually have less of those GC2 collections because we can do some work in the background every time we have to collect the lower ephemeral segment generations. And in addition to that, we can also have lower latency peaks for generation 2 collections. So that's basically what the background GC does. It's something you just get for free because it's an optimization to the GC. But it's kind of important to know that, you know, there has been some work done on that level as well. Now, beyond that, I want to talk also very briefly about the programmability story for parallel computing. So a couple of years ago, basically some teams at Microsoft sat together to say, well, we need to do something about this parallel beast. And one of the first things that were actually done was the creation of some libraries to assist in creating parallel programs. So, and that's called the parallel extensions, which actually has shipped for .NET 3.5 for a while, actually as a beta release. While we were sort of noodling around with doing exactly the same thing for .NET 4.0. And so you can write programs that basically use two kinds of parallelism. One is called, you know, task-driven parallelism, which is called parallel algorithms. The other one is, you know, data parallelism, where you have, you know, huge amounts of data that you can sort of chunk in pieces and do operations simultaneously on the different portions of that data. So you can use this stuff from any single language because we're not, you know, changing the language to allow those parallel extensions. And then we actually call into different libraries. So we have the TPL, or task parallel library, which contains the new concept of a task. So the task is a unit of concurrency, much like a thread, but it doesn't take affinity on operating system threads at the point it's being created. So it can actually migrate across different CPUs. It can, you know, load balance based on work stealing. And, you know, at some point, of course, there will be a physical thread, you know, backing that particular thing to execute. And on the right-hand side, we have something called the coordination data structures, which contains things like thread-safe collections, like, you know, a blocking, not a blocking, but a concurrent queue, so you don't have to lock from the outside. And we have some additional synchronization types that are more efficient, avoiding to go, for example, into kernel mode. So we have things there like manual reset event slim, which is, you know, a less expensive kind of reset event than the manual reset event itself. Now, on top of that, we built P-Link. P-Link is, you know, the data parallelism. And again, you know, that turns into task parallelism because, you know, if you have a query over huge amounts of data, what we can basically do is we can chunk pieces up and say, you know, one CPU, you're going to do this, and another CPU, you're going to do that. So here I have a sample of the parallel loop APIs. I'm actually just going to show it to you in code in just a second, but The main thing here is that by actually providing you some very simple primitives, it becomes very easy to try whether you can parallelize something without overhauling your entire code, you know, just to try to parallelize this thing. Because matrix multiplication, well, you can do the individual cells in parallel, like there's no reason you couldn't do that. But if you want to do that manually, well, you have to chunk up the work across multiple CPUs, create multiple threads. You should not create more threads than you have CPUs. Well, you could do that, but like if you have a 1,000 times 1,000 matrix and you're just naive, you're just going to say for every row I'm going to spawn a thread, and you know the kernel will not be that happy if you create 1,000 threads. So you have to be, you know, smart about that, and typically this code gets very cumbersome because you need lots of events and all of that stuff. So parallel 4 actually helps you to sort of, you know, try out whether you can optimize something, and if it works, well, you just keep it. If it doesn't work, you can revert it, and it's just, you know, a couple of seconds work. Same with p-link. To parallelize a query, in this particular case, assume that you have 1 million people sitting somewhere in memory. Well, if you want to do a query over that, there's no reason you can't, you know, do the filtering on different CPUs at the same time, saying you're going to filter, you know, 100,000 users, you're also going to filter 100,000 users, and so forth. We can even do things like work sealing, meaning if one CPU runs out of juice, like it doesn't have any filter operations to be done anymore, it can steal work from a CPU that's not done yet. So we can actually be much more efficient in terms of throughput. So actually, a couple of samples about parallel. So we have tasks and we have p-link. So the task side of things, I'm actually doing the matrix multiplication sample here, where I basically have a matrix of 500 times 500. I have two of those guys. I basically create a random number generator just to stuff some random data into those. And then I want to compute the result, and I'm just using, you know, the algorithm that's being used to do that multiplication. Now, I also have some measure here, so I'm basically using some delegate that I will basically measure using the stopwatch. So I have a measure method that takes in, you know, some title, an action, it runs the stopwatch, executes the action, and then prints how long it took to execute the complete action. So a very simple measurement method. So the non-parallel one, multiplying matrices, is, you know, pretty simple and straightforward. We just go over rows and columns, and we basically populate the individual cells based on, you know, the multiplication and the sum of the multiplications. So in order to parallelize that, we could say, well, in the resulting matrix, we can do rows independently. We can say, you know, one CPU, you go ahead and multiply, you know, the cells in this row. The other one does another row instead. So to parallelize this code, I actually already have the code sitting here, but, you know, I will just do it manually to emphasize how easy it actually is. You say, I want to have a parallel for loop, and you can also have parallel for each loops and parallel invocations and, you know, different kinds of parallelism here. And so now I have to specify, you know, the inclusive lower bound, which will be 0, the exclusive upper bound, which will be size, and I don't have to do the I++ thing. It sort of encapsulates the regular for loop here. And instead of that, I need to have an action that basically takes in an int that's fed to, you know, the body to be executed, and then, you know, I can just use lambda syntax to do so. So here I'm going from 0 to size exclusively, and for all of those I'm basically feeding in the value of the iteration to the body. And this causes, essentially, in this case of 500 times 500, it causes 500 tasks to be created for all the individual, you know, inner loops. And those do not get executed immediately. They're simply queued up, and, you know, CPUs will, you know, start getting work and basically executing those things. So when I execute this code, you will see that the sequential version actually takes like 4 seconds, and the other one only takes like 2.18 seconds. So it's almost twice a speed up in this particular case. And if I would open up the task manager here and execute this thing, and I'm a little quick, you see while the sequential version is going, I only have 50% CPU use, and while the parallel is going, I got a peak of 100% CPU use because both CPUs were busy at that point in time. So this was the sequential version, this was the parallel version. Now another kind of parallelism is the data parallelism called P-Link. And again, that's a pretty simple thing to do. I'm using a typical sample here called the Link Ray Tracer. It's something created by a guy called Luke Hoban on the F-Sharp team before he actually went to the dark side of F-Sharp. And so what he did here was he basically created a ray tracer, which is something that renders funny images on the screen. And it actually does so by using a link query. It's a link query that basically goes over, you know, the height of the screen and the width of the screen. So it's like 800 times 600 pixels. That's quite some pixels to be computed. And you can compute those pixels in parallel. Like, you know, one pixel can be computed while the other one is being computed. Now, how this link query works, well, you almost need, you know, some PhD to understand this thing, but it basically, you know, works over a huge amount of data, and for all of that data, it does things like, you know, wheres and all of those operations. So it's kind of a gigantic query, you know, this is the entire query, but, you know, it's just using link, you know, it's working over data. Now, to parallelize that thing, you basically copy the whole thing, and you basically put S parallel on the enumerable dot range. So I'm going to take this whole thing, and here, well, I already did it before in my previous you know, presentation of this. So I just copied the whole thing and put S parallel on, you know, the outermost range in this particular case. And so when I execute this thing, this whole thing can be parallelized, like CPUs can actually be computing pixels in parallel. So again, let me open up Task Manager here. I'll do the sequential version, and you will see that only one single vertical line is being rendered at the same time, or horizontal if you look that way. Like, you know, you see lines being rendered just, you know, sequentially, top to bottom. And this takes about, you know, 13 seconds. And again, you know, the CPU, like one CPU was not doing anything useful. Now, if I go for the parallel version, you see multiple lines being drawn at the same time. I didn't have to change the code that much for that. I simply said S parallel. And that means that, you know, the TPL is basically decomposing my query into individual chunks that can be dispatched to different CPUs. So in this case, every line was drawn by its own CPU, creating, you know, separate tasks for all of the individual lines. And as you can see, as a result, I got 100% CPU, and it only took 7 seconds to complete. So that's a pretty visual sample of the use of P-Link. So with that, so far for the parallel stuff. A couple of things to conclude. One thing I wanted to talk about very briefly is corrupted state exceptions. So I'm back, you know, to the core runtime here. Exception handling is one of the core facilities that the CLR provides. Now, one of the exceptions you could actually catch before in CLR 2.0 was the access violation exception. Now, an access violation and, you know, corrupted memory and all of that stuff that comes from it, or, you know, that's actually triggering that particular access violation typically indicates something is totally busted in your application. So before you could actually handle those exceptions, meaning that, you know, you might be operating on memory that's actually corrupt. So that wasn't the best situation to be in, so we added a couple of things to the blacklist of corrupted state exceptions that are now not catchable anymore. Unless you actually say that you have magical powers on your method and you say, I can handle, you know, corrupted state exceptions. And then your filter will, or your exception handler will still see those particular exceptions coming through. Again, you know, in typical cases, this means, you know, that, you know, that particular exception causes your memory to be busted. It's better not to handle it, to stay off of it. But, you know, if you have some reason you believe that you can actually handle those, you could still use that particular attribute to do so. Now, concerning debugging, debugging is also one of the core services that the CLR provides. So in CLR 4.0, we have mixed mode debugging support for native code and managed code in the same process on x64, which is something that we actually didn't support in Visual Studio 2008. In addition to that, we have some additional APIs that can actually be used to debug, you know, locking problems, and that's actually been very useful for the TPL itself. And we also have dump debugging support, which I want to show you very briefly because it's kind of exciting. So the thing we did here is we implemented the iCore debugging services interfaces on top of dump files as well, meaning that we can basically use exactly the same debugger facilities in Visual Studio to do dump debugging. So if you get, you know, a crash report of your application which contains a memory dump, now you can actually do so or investigate this thing inside Visual Studio directly. So let me actually show you this guy in practice. Now, in reality, of course, you know, the application would crash on some server. You would take a dump over there, or you might even be using, you know, the Windows corporate error reporting services so that you actually get dump debugging for your application sent to you. I'm not going to do any of that. I'm just going to crash an application locally and take a dump using some local debugger. So let me actually mimic the situation of an application crashing. So I have something called div.cs here. It is just a plain simple sample that can crash in four different ways. You can give it too little arguments, so you will have an array out of bounds exception on one of those. You might give it non-numerical values, so it might crash here or it might crash there. And you might also give it a division by zero. So not the most exciting thing, but you know, at least I can crash it by doing something like div4.0. And at this point, you know, you could actually start a debugger. And you know, this is live debugging on the application that actually is crashing. Now, instead of doing so, I will actually basically use debug.bat, which is a little script I wrote here that runs this particular executable under a debugger. And I'm just going to mimic the situation that we're creating a dump file. Now, this could be, you know, the Watson services at Microsoft creating a dump file. So you basically send the dump report to Microsoft, and you can actually subscribe to get dumps for your application. Or you might be on some server attaching to a crashing process and just taking a dump file. So I'm just going to execute here. I got the, you know, exception, and in reality at this point, you know, some service could be automatically creating a dump file, putting it on some share, and you're the poor developer that needs to investigate the issue. So now I have oops.dmp setting here. I will just quit this debugger. So I have oops.dmp created right now. My clock is still off. But so when I open this thing in DevEnv, which is just Visual Studio, you will now see that we can actually, you know, we get some summary of the dump, where it was created at what time. I can start debugging with mixed mode or native only. And you know, we resolve the symbols, we get the call stack, and you can take a look at the memory watch windows, at the local variables, all of that inside Visual Studio on a dump that, you know, has crashed a couple of weeks ago or something. So pretty, you know, interesting stuff. If you have to do lots of dump debugging, in the past you were sort of noodling around with SOS and all of that stuff. Yes? This is for Visual Studio. Oh, you mean every edition of Visual Studio. I think that's actually the case, yes. Yeah, I'm not 100% sure, but I believe that that is indeed the case, because it's a core runtime service that actually just, you know, happens to work on dump files. So do you want to stop debugging? Yes. Okay. So with that, you know, I sort of had the meat of the session here. I have some additional resources on stuff like code contracts, which I don't really have the time to get into quite deeply. We actually have one of the guys who worked remotely on code contracts here today. He's actually Pelly. He's giving a session about MOLS, another Microsoft research project. So, you know, any questions about code contracts, you can always, you know, contact those people, or you can go to the Microsoft DevLabs release. The basic idea of code contracts, in just a nutshell, is to annotate your code with more invariants. Like, for example, here you're saying, I have a method, buy more stuff, and I don't expect the cart to be null. And I want every entry in my cart not to be equal to something I'm now ordering. Like, if it's already there, you just have to boost the quantity. You shouldn't, you know, add the same thing to the existing cart. The total cost should be larger or equal to zero. So you put all of those contracts in there, which can be preconditions, postconditions, invariants, all of that stuff. And if you do so, we can actually provide you tooling support inside Visual Studio through the MSDN DevLabs release to analyze your code and figure out, you know, where you sort of go wrong in certain call stacks. Like, for example, if you try to feed in a null argument, it's much easier to know at the point you're feeding in the null argument than seeing an exception at the point it's detected that you did something wrong. And so if you install the MSDN DevLabs release, you actually get some tools on top of code contracts that basically can help you analyze your code. I'm just going to show this very briefly here in sample 7. And that's something, you know, I will put all the samples also online. But so here I have a very simple sample that says for bar, you basically feed in some string p, and you don't want this thing to be null. Now, if you install the DevLabs release, so you go to MSDN DevLabs code projects or code contracts, you get some tab here where you can basically say, given code contract annotations in my code, please perform runtime checking or perform static checking, meaning that at compile time, we'll basically use a theorem prover to reason about all the code paths in your code and make sure that you're not violating the non-null argument in this particular case. So if you try that on this particular piece of code, and I would actually do this, you see here that code contract says requires is false, p is not null. If you double-click there, you actually see squigglies here saying that you're violating a contract much more down the call stack at the point you're actually trying to violate the contract. And, you know, if you enforce this at runtime, you will actually get asserts, or you could also have, you know, the tools of DevLabs cross-compiling those things into, for example, argument null exceptions. So this is basically code contracts in a nutshell. Again, it's something, you know, that the framework sort of provides for by just providing the code contracts methods. The tool set is something that doesn't ship with Visual Studio at this point. You actually have to download that separately. But at least you can start, you know, annotating your code with more invariants. And if you use Reflector on the BCL, you will actually see that things like collections have quite some code contracts in them. So we're using that stuff to make sure that the core functionality is not broken. So with that, you know, I want to conclude. If there are any questions, I will stay around for a while. You can actually raise your hand now as well. I believe there's some pause. I will be around, so with that, you know, if there are questions, let me know. No? Okay, thank you.